Did that make any sense to you? That your son would be committing a burglary?
Amal wasn't burglarizing anything. Amal was just running. I've been told lies.
And now the verdict is in.
I understand you have reached a verdict.
The murder of Ahmaud Arbery shocked the conscience of the nation.
No peace!
But there's so much more to this story that you never heard before.
Greg McMichael and Travis McMichael chased this young man in the street and hunted him down and shot him.
Okay.
As soon as he says that, they begin to take everything that he says at face value.
No,
I'm
sorry.
No. Why would you be in cuffs?
Well, the video changed everything.
Just 36 seconds of grainy video.
You're now dealing with the whole world watching.
There's nothing else I can do. This doesn't look good. I mean, it just shot me.
Anyone who saw that video, their reaction was, good God, this is a lynching.
Did you think that you would be able to get justice as a black woman in a small Georgia town?
I promised him that I would find out what happened.
Love running past the oak trees and the pine trees.
He liked it because it was peaceful. He was at home when he ran.
He just loved smelling the sea salt as he ran.
If it wasn't drenching in rain, Ahmaud would be running.
Ahmaud Arbery was Wanda Cooper Jones and Marcus Arbery Sr.'s third child. They had an older son, Marcus Jr., and they also had a daughter, Jasmine.
Ahmaud was the baby. I had Ahmaud on Mother's Day. I knew Ahmaud would be the last one, though I cherished Ahmaud.
And he was your Mother's Day gift?
Yes. We shared a very special bond. Ahmaud was the kid that would come in and give me a kiss on the cheek. Or just come in and give me a hug around the neck.
In a day passed by, he gonna tell you that he loved you. And he didn't just tell you that, he showed that.
He was a funny guy, always wanted to keep people laughing. We all be joked out, and he gonna be right in the center of it, making us laugh.
Right or wrong, if you his family, he gonna stick with you beside you. He was a great kid.
When he knew I was having a bad day, he would come in and say something that he thought was funny to get me to smile. His goal was to make me happy, and he did that. We don't take any time for granted at this point. The last time we saw
life was pretty tough for Wanda. She was a primary caregiver, raising three children and often working two jobs.
I constantly asked her, was being a mom to three and raising it on your own, was it tiring? She would tell me all the time that was one of the best roles she had ever played.
The family lived in Brunswick, a small town in the southeast corner of Georgia.
Brunswick is an idyllic town if you want to live near water and off the coast.
It's very tropical. You got three islands that are nearby.
And there's only a little more than 16,000 people in Brunswick. So it is a small southern town.
One, two, three, up!
Ahmaud wasn't just a casual runner. He was a natural-born athlete. He loved sports, basketball, boxing.
But I think Ahmaud's particular love of football was something that was extraordinary.
Ahmaud started playing football when he was about five.
It's the South, so sports in the South is crazy.
Just listen to the energy at the football stadium where Ahmaud once played.
You go to a high school game right now, the whole city come out, you know. Football is very important down there.
There's nothing like it.
At Brunswick High, Ahmaud was known as a hard hitter and a mighty linebacker.
Once they put him in the game, his heart overtook it. It really scared me because he wasn't that big, but when I seen him play, I said, wow, his heart bigger than his size.
A lot of young people who have less opportunity see sports as a way to achieve not only material success, but also I think to have a sense of identity and the adoration of the people that you grew up with.
It's a path of something different and peace, and it's a way to let yourself be free.
He was on a mission. He knew what he wanted out of life.
He wanted to buy a plot of land and build houses with him and his best friend so they could all live close together and raise their families together.
As kids, Ahmad and his older brother, Marcus Jr., would sometimes fantasize about what life would be like outside of Brunswick.
Every day we dream about playing in the NFL.
They wanted one of them to sign a big, huge, multi-million dollar NFL contract.
And one of us gonna have to go to the NFL. One of us gonna make mama rich.
And they were gonna buy Wanda a nice big house.
This wasn't exactly a far-fetched dream. Three former players from the Brunswick Pirates actually went on to play for the NFL, including Ahmad's cousin, Tracy Walker, who plays for the Detroit Lions.
Intercepted by Tracy Walker!
And Darius Slay III, who plays for the Philadelphia Eagles.
Intercepted! Darius Slay! Slay has done it again!
While Darius and Tracy went on to play football and ultimately to the NFL, it didn't happen for Ahmad.
When he finished high school, he didn't have any college football offers.
He was a small linebacker, and the colleges just didn't want someone that size playing that position.
I told him, you're young. You still got a chance to do anything in this world you want.
After graduation, Ahmad moved out and went to technical college. He was hoping to become an electrician.
Once the dream of football faded, it was harder to focus on school. So he came home and he started working, and I think he was really trying to figure out what else he was gonna do with his life.
So he eventually left college and came back home to live with your mom. Why didn't he go back?
A change of thought, maybe. Maybe this is not what I wanna do. And he started working and making a living for himself. I guess he got used to making money and tired of being a broke college student.
Was he sort of the man of the house in some ways?
He was. Ahmad helped me in so many ways, not for us financially, but emotionally as well. Ahmad didn't realize how much I was actually depending on him at that point.
I met him at my first job. It was at McDonald's. He had like this smooth skin, this nice smile. We complimented each other.
He loved his girlfriend, and he was really shy when he first met her.
We literally just clicked. He played sports, I played sports. He'll come to my house, we're working out together, we're eating together, we're looking at movies together. My friends could not catch me at that point. Like, they knew when I was with Ma, there was just no way Shanice is not going anywhere at that point.
Later into the relationship, he loved her so much that he would record their phone calls just so he could listen to her voice.
Wanda became concerned after her son dropped out of college and came back home. There were changes in his behavior. He's now at home. Was he struggling with that decision and where he was in his life?
Returning home at that age after being away, I think it did take a toll of him.
When Ahmad came home and went to a high school basketball game, he had a firearm on him. He was arrested.
After Ahmad was caught with that gun, he was put on probation. And later, he was arrested a second time for shoplifting.
My brother was no angel, but he was my angel.
He'd made mistakes like everyone does, and I think was trying to get his life back on track. He was not sent to jail. Ahmad's crimes were not violent crimes.
Wanda noticed that her youngest son didn't seem to be himself.
I was concerned because he had lost his motivation. He wasn't talking as much. I just had concerns as a mother, and my job as mom was to stick beside him.
Did you lose faith in him?
No, ma'am. Ahmad was the baby. Ahmad was still my son. Ahmad still was a brother. No, never. My cell phone rang. When I heard Glynn County Police Department, I knew it was something wrong. How wrong it was, I didn't know.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Traveled to Dallas for some training, and when I left Ahmad, I went to his room. I told Ahmad I was leaving. I said, I'll be back in a couple of days. And I said, I love you, and his last words to me was, I love you.
Four days later, when she's on her way home from Texas, Wanda gets a phone call from the local police.
He said Ahmad was committing a burglary. He was confronted, and in that confrontation, there was a struggle over the firearm, and Ahmad was killed.
Did that make any sense to you, that your son would be committing a burglary?
No, ma'am. No sense at all.
She was unwilling to accept that information because she knew that what she was being told was not the character of her son.
That's not him. I knew that wasn't him.
So nobody was satisfied with this idea that he was shot and killed during a burglary?
No. My brother is one of the trustworthiest people that I know. I didn't believe it. I remember picking out a casket for my little brother. What he would wear, what would be in his obituary. Things like that I never thought I would do. At such a young age.
As a young mom, I used to say I didn't imagine life without my children. And now that day had came, it was one of the hardest days of my life.
I really like this wreath because it has his name embroidered on it.
You said something to your son at the funeral.
I promised him that I would find out what happened. They had told me that he had burglarized something. And I know that he hadn't did that. And Ahmad knew the type of mom I was, that I was going to find out what happened. He knew that.
The day that we laid Ahmad to rest, those were her last words to him. We're going to find out what happened, but we're going to get justice.
She said it over and over again. She's gonna find out what happened. She's gonna find out what happened. And she is.
We laid him to rest on that Saturday. And that Monday morning when I woke up, I said, now it's time. It's time to find answers.
Ahmad died in a quiet subdivision of Brunswick called Satilla Shores. According to the Glynn County Police report, 34-year-old Travis McMichael and his father, Gregory, had seen Ahmad running through their neighborhood. So they began chasing him in their white pickup truck.
They saw Ahmad running. They grabbed the guns and they ran behind him.
They admitted to targeting her son because he looked suspicious.
What are you now beginning to think?
That I've been told lies. What I was told by the detective was all wrong. Police report was totally different. Ahmad wasn't burglarizing anything. Ahmad was just running.
and Greg McMichael and Travis McMichael chase this young man in the street and hunted him down and shot him.
In the Glynn County Police report, Wanda learns more about the details of that day.
Travis McMichael shot Ahmaud Arbery 3 times at close range with a shotgun.
6-7 around 48.
All right, guys, everybody's got their weapons up, correct?
Everybody's got their weapons.
Okay.
While Ahmaud Arbery lay dying in the streets, with Travis McMichael literally covered in Ahmaud Arbery's blood.
A black male, middle of the roadway, looks like about mid-20s.
Law enforcement began their investigation.
When police arrived on the scene inside Satilla Shores that day, Greg McMichael was almost animated in describing what had happened.
We see him come around the corner. He's going down here. We pull up beside him. Hey, stop, stop. We want to talk to you. And he just keeps on running.
Travis McMichael, who had fired the fatal shots, was, you know, much more subdued. He was sitting on a curb.
Just breathe, okay?
Ahmaud's body was less than 10 feet away.
And then that's my father. He was with me with his own thing.
Greg McMichael established the narrative, and he said Ahmaud attacked his son, and Travis had acted in self-defense. And Greg McMichael tells the officers that, you know, I would have shot him myself if I had to.
So, to be honest with you, if I could have got a shot at the guy, I'd have shot him myself.
When the police arrive, Gregory McMichael talks about his long history in law enforcement.
So I grabbed my 357 Magnum, it's an old Glynn County PD issue, by the way.
That he's just basically one of them.
You know, I was chief investigator with the DA's office for 23 years, so I know what you got to do. Yep. I know everything, you know.
Yep. Greg McMichael was formerly a police officer, and then he went to work for the district attorney's office.
As soon as he says that, they drop their guard and begin to give him professional courtesy. They don't look at him as someone who's perpetrated possibly a crime. They begin to look at him as a colleague. And they begin to take everything that he says at face value.
Yeah, it was just a damn melee, you know. Yeah.
They accepted everything he had to say as gospel.
What are they doing with my son over there? Are they?
I don't know, sir.
After the shooting occurs, Gregory McMichael calls his former boss, Jackie Johnson.
Jackie Johnson was the longtime district attorney down in Brunswick.
Jackie, this is Greg. Can you call me as soon as possibly can? My son and I have been involved in a shooting, and I need some advice right away. If you can please call me as soon as you possibly can. Thank you. Bye.
Greg McMichael calls his former boss, District Attorney Jackie Johnson, saying, I've been involved in a shooting. I need some advice. Please call me. We don't know for sure if they ever actually connected and talked. There's nothing in the records that they actually talked in person.
Jackie Johnson told law enforcement officers that day that they should not arrest Travis McMichael for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery.
And so the process was influenced by persons that had relationships with the McMichaels.
The McMichaels were brought down to the police station, interviewed, and released.
There were no arrests. It was as if there had been a traffic accident. And after questioning, Greg McMichael and Travis McMichael went home. Story about power, really, in a small Georgia town, but it's who you knew and who you didn't know.
Did you think that you would be able to get justice as a black woman in a small Georgia town?
I knew the odds of getting justice for Ahmaud was not on my side. I knew that. Ahmaud was killed on a sunny Sunday afternoon, and no one went to jail. To Brunswick, got visited where Ahmaud fell. I would go there and sit there just to have that connection on where he took his last breath. I thought Ahmaud was just running in my neighborhood. I had no idea that he had ventured out into a neighborhood across the highway.
There's a highway that cuts through Brunswick that takes vacationers off to pretty beaches.
Interstate 17 works as a kind of dividing line between Brunswick and Satilla Shores. The people who live on the Satilla Shores side are more affluent. They have better schools, better housing. The people that live on Ahmad's side of Interstate 17 are, for the most part, impoverished. And so you can imagine what it feels like to be separated from another way of life, and not by a lot of distance. And I think that had something to do with why Ahmad would run on the other side of Interstate 17, be able to see another way of life and imagine it for himself.
Wanted to live in a neighborhood with mixed nationalities. And she said that he was safe until he crossed the road into the white neighborhood.
Was there a racial divide? Was he running in the white section of town?
He was. If I would have known, I would have asked him to stop because I knew it wasn't safe. I've been a resident of Glynn County since I was like 18, so I know that that stuff is there.
When you say that stuff is there, what do you mean?
The prejudice, the racism.
In order to get to Satilla Shores from his neighborhood, Ahmad had to run by residences that had Confederate flags flying out front.
I hate to say it, but racial profiling does happen here. And I've experienced it myself. And I'm a pastor. It's unfortunate, but it does happen.
A lot of people classified it in this case as Ahmaud Arbery was guilty of one thing, running while black. This is a story about power, really. I'm in a small Georgia town. It's who you knew and who you didn't know. And Ahmaud Arbery's mother had no connections, didn't know anybody.
I knew that I had to do something because I was being ignored. Days and weeks had passed and these people were still free.
To have to deal with your son being murdered and then nobody's arrested, no justice.
They absolutely underestimated Wanda Cooper Jones.
She was dogged in her pursuit of the truth in this case.
They thought that one single black woman was not going to be as disruptive as she ultimately proved to be.
There was clearly some conflicts right away.
Jackie Johnson immediately recognized she had a problem because Greg McMichael had worked for her.
Glynn County District Attorney Jackie Johnson recused herself after the shooting happened. A district attorney from a neighboring area, George Barnhill, picks up the case.
George Barnhill is another longtime district attorney in South Georgia.
Basically, I was hoping that the DA would call me and tell me that he had indictments for arrest. So that was my prayer.
At the same time, the country was finding out about this COVID outbreak. And so you had a local tragedy taking place, but then you had a national, global tragedy that was taking place. And I think it was pushed aside.
So she starts digging into this herself by Googling. She didn't have a lawyer, she didn't have investigators. She went out, she Googled.
So I turned into an investigator.
Wanda says she found a connection between Greg McMichael and George Barnhill on social media.
I went to social media and found Gregory McMichael's and his friends named George Barnhill.
The district attorney?
Yes. So then when I went to Mr. Barnhill's page, I saw he had a son.
She finds out that George Barnhill's son works for the DA in Glynn County, where Raymond Michael had worked all those years.
The new DA had personal connections and ties with both Jackie Johnson and the McMichaels himself.
She told me that she didn't think it was right for the case to go to him. And she was on the phone calling the attorney general. She was calling anybody who would listen.
Every morning, I wake up and make a phone call, and no one would return my phone calls.
I couldn't imagine what she felt like as a mother and having door after door slam in your face, but she kept on pursuing, she kept on digging.
Wanda's tireless efforts eventually yielded results.
George Barnhill will recuse himself from the case because of Wanda Cooper Jones beating the drum that, you know, something's not right here.
So that was like a small victory.
In recusing himself, D.A. Barnhill denied any allegations of bias.
But he made sure before he left to write a letter to the Glynn County Police saying, this is self-defense, there's no criminal charges warranted, nothing to see here, is basically the tenor of the letter.
And so he created the foundation of the argument that they did nothing wrong.
In his letter, D.A. Barnhill writes, it's our conclusion that there's insufficient probable cause to issue arrest warrants at this time.
It's shocking for a prosecutor to make that statement.
Really what Wanda had said, that, you know, this was being swept under the rug, it was laid bare in that letter.
It was the get out of jail free card for the McMichaels.
The case is then handed over to another district attorney, Tom Durden.
Tom Durden, the third DA in the case, was considering convening a grand jury. But because of the pandemic, the courts in Georgia were closed.
How frustrating was it for the family?
It seems like everyone is going on with their life. But we're still stuck here and we're screaming at the top of our lungs and nobody's listening to what happened.
It had been 2 months since her son's death, and out of the blue, a New York Times reporter reaches out to Wanda about telling Ahmad's story.
I told him what I was up against, and he said, I can help. And Ms. Roberts, no one had ever told me that.
It was the first time the case got attention in the national media.
Her pursuit of justice proved it was more to the story.
What came a few weeks later would shock the nation. Just 36 seconds of grainy video. Suddenly the world knows the name Ahmaud Arbery.
That was really where the case took a big turn.
It was sickening. I can't say this any more clear. It was like he was treated like an animal. Gunned down.
This morning, the race to find a potential COVID-19 vaccine.
The total number of COVID cases in the U.S. now around 1.2 million.
The pandemic was full blown, and we were talking about shutdown.
Dozens of plants closed across the country, thousands of workers sick.
And courts were closed. So all of that made it difficult for this case to break through. And that is, of course, until the video came out.
Breaking overnight.
The video changed everything.
Showing this 25-year-old unarmed man.
It was the first week of May in 2020, and WGIG, a Brunswick radio station, posts on its Twitter account a video of Ahmaud Arbery being chased through the streets of Satilla Shores.
It was like a dream, a nightmare. I couldn't believe that this was happening in our city.
Just 36 seconds of grainy video showing the last moments of Ahmaud Arbery's life.
I still remember today. Our lawyer, he called and told us to give a break of social media today.
He didn't want you to see this?
He didn't want us to see the video.
My daughter, she called me and cried. It tore her apart. It tore my whole family apart. I never seen nothing like this before. And when I seen my kid running for his poor dear life, and I wasn't there to help him, that thing really cooled me down.
Did you watch the video?
I saw the last couple of seconds. I can see Ahmaud
and he had turned to run away. And what I carry is seeing him as he's falling. And it breaks my heart.
When Michael's perpetrated all of this, they chased the young man. They put him in a situation where he feared for his life. And as a result of fearing for his life, he tried to defend his life. And then they shot him dead.
Anyone who saw that video, their reaction was, good God, this is a lynching.
There's growing outrage over chilling video showing the deadly shooting.
25-year-old unarmed black man who was chased by two white men and fatally shot.
No arrests have been made. The community is demanding answers.
No peace! No peace!
It was a stressful time, and it could have went a lot of ways. I saw the city really come together like I'd never seen before. Of course, there was a crisis, but nevertheless, we came together.
Everybody's hollering about justice, but it really is just us. Yes. We're tired of it.
I think most of our citizens of the white community were unaware that this level of injustice was still being carried out. And their support to get justice was refreshing.
Once the cell phone video became public, it was just a matter of a day or two before Georgia's governor, Brian Kemp, asked the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to take over this case. Within 36 hours, GBI agents were at the McMichaels house putting handcuffs on Greg and Travis.
Father and son caught on camera in that fatal incident have now been arrested and charged with murder.
My older son Marcus called and he said, Mama, they got him. They got the McMichaels.
74 days after he was shot and killed, the McMichaels are arrested. What did that feel like for you after working so hard?
It was unbelievable. I knew that God had heard my prayers.
Until they are convicted and behind bars.
The Georgia Attorney General replaced the third DA at his own request.
A new prosecutor has been assigned to the case of Ahmaud Arbery.
It was early May. I was appointed as the special prosecutor in the case of Ahmaud Arbery's murder, being the fourth prosecutor to be involved. And that family is reeling. And you feel the emotion of what you are tasked with doing.
No justice!
No peace!
And no justice!
You're now dealing with the whole world watching.
After the video was released, there was this examination as to how did all these months pass by, and there was no progress in the investigation into this case.
It's important to note that law enforcement has had the video of the shooting from day one.
It was hard to believe that that video could be seen and police not acting on it. The people who were making the decision on whether or not to prosecute William Michaels not acting on it.
It was just hard for me to believe that we had elected and paid officials that had the knowledge of this video and still found a way not to do their jobs.
It is an amazing thing that we can all as human beings look at the same video and see something so different.
The sole reason it became public is because the McMichaels and their supporters thought it would prove their case. They thought it would prove that this was self-defense.
The McMichaels wanted the video released.
They saw it as exonerated.
They felt that it helped their case.
When you see the video, you consider it
a video of a murder, perhaps. When some people see the video, they see it as two men trying to effectuate an arrest and the arrestee resisting arrest, trying to then kill the arrestors and self-defense at hand.
Graben Michael thought it cleared him. It thought it told his story. I mean, obviously, that's not how the rest of the country saw it.
Now, everybody wants to know who shot that video.
One of the neighbors saw a pickup truck with a man in it. So I know that it was a third party. I just didn't know what part he played in it.
A lot of times these videos are shot by witnesses or someone who's not involved in the case. This case was not that. It was shot by one of the eventual defendants.
After the release of that video of Travis McMichael killing Ahmaud Arbery, hundreds of people gathered peacefully in Brunswick to honor Ahmaud on what would have been his 26th birthday.
I have a black son too, and I'm afraid for him every day to be walking out in these streets.
I attended a lot of rallies in the South Georgia area. Every county that we visited, moms would come to me and say, I lost my child. Police killed my child.
Wanda Cooper Jones was convinced that somebody else might have been involved in her son's death.
She had no problem saying, well, look, two arrests are nice, but we want to make sure that everyone involved in my son's murder pay for it.
Almost a week after that video came out, a man named William Roddy Bryan speaks to ABC News.
I've never experienced anything like that before. Whoever the young man was, that I did not know. I don't really know what else to say other than it was unsettling.
Ryan's attorney, Mr. Goff, began to offer up his client as a witness to this terrible incident.
My client was trying to take a video of what was going on. I don't think there was any question that Roddy was one of the good guys.
His lawyer kind of goes on the offensive and says, Roddy's a victim here. In some ways, he just shot a video. He's just a bystander.
Roddy Bryan sees a young man running down the street that he doesn't know, okay? And he's not running to anything. He's running from something, okay? And then a white pickup truck that he recognizes from the neighborhood comes by. And he goes in his house. He gets his keys. He has his cell phone, and he gets in his truck. Somewhere after he pulls out, he starts recording.
I pray for the family. I'm sorry for your loss. I'm not proud that I shot the video, but maybe it helps in the end.
He apologized for the pain that Wanda was experiencing. It was really one of the more mystifying aspects of the case.
2 weeks after Bryan spoke to ABC News, he was interviewed by the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
The man who captured that video, now arrested. William Roddy Bryan has been arrested by Georgia authorities on charges including felony murder.
We had Roddy Bryan arrested because we believed that he was just as culpable as the McMichaels in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. Now, this was during COVID. So we were able to follow CDC guidelines to impanel a grand jury, after which all three of the current defendants were indicted.
Justice! No!
The murder of Ahmaud Arbery shocked the conscience of the nation. And then George Floyd was killed.
I can't breathe! No justice! No peace!
It's really the first global anti-racist movement that we'd ever seen. The protests were multi-generational, they were multi-racial, but to do so in the middle of a pandemic, millions and millions of mass people all over the planet, the back-to-back murders of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, really put on display the extent to which Black lives do not have value.
Greg certainly didn't want Ahmaud Arbery to get hurt or killed.
Is Greg McMichael a racist?
Well, what's your definition of racist?
There was a perspective in that neighborhood that they were being menaced by somebody.
And now there's a second video that might show that and change everything.
There's somebody back over there on the property again tonight. It's a black male. Looks like he's up to no good.
A lot of people cannot understand how did a man lose his life when there was no evidence of a serious crime being committed.
That's the wrong question. It's inaccurate.
What's the right question? What did the jury believe?
I understand you have reached a verdict as to each defendant.
If you see a white man running, you think, well, there's a jogger. If you see a black man running, I think you call into question why he's running.
He was just wandering around under the carport. Looks like he's up to no good.
If he didn't have his belief that he was actually committing burglaries, then all you would have is there's a black man running.
We pull up beside him, hey, stop, we want to talk to you. And he just keeps on running.
I can't say this any more clear. It was like he was treated like an animal, gunned down.
This case is not about racism or racist motives. This is just a neighborhood and some people trying to do the best they could to stop the crime in the neighborhood.
When you hear that they say that race has no bearing on this case, what is your reaction?
There's three men chasing a black young man. He's unarmed, they have weapons, they have a truck. What else could it be?
The three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery were in custody.
At this point, we call Richard Dial from the Georgia Bureau of Investigations to the witness stand. From the video, you can tell that Mr. Arbery comes out of the residence.
GBI investigator Richard Dial testifies at a June 4th preliminary hearing, laying out with video and other evidence what really may have happened on February 23rd, 2020. Ahmaud set out from his home that sunny Sunday, and about 2 miles later, crossed over into the Satilla Shores neighborhood.
When you look at the street layout of Satilla Shores, it's a bunch of winding streets like most subdivisions are.
The first time we see Ahmaud Arbery in Satilla Shores is from a porch camera. The timing on that porch camera is off by about an hour and 5 minutes. At 1:04 p.m., he enters a home that's under construction.
Ahmaud Arbery stops and walks in this house. Surveillance video shows him just walking around, looking.
That construction site sort of became ground zero of all this.
At 1:08 p.m., a neighbor is captured on that incorrectly timed porch camera, calling police concerned about reported break-ins in the neighborhood.
There's a guy in the house right now. He's at the house under construction.
And you said someone's breaking into it right now?
No, it's all open, it's under construction.
4 minutes after he enters, Ahmaud Arbery exits the house and continues running.
And he's running right now. There he goes right now.
Okay. I just need to know what he was doing wrong.
He's been caught on the camera a bunch before at night. It's kind of an ongoing thing out here.
A different home camera picks up an image of Ahmaud as he heads deeper into Satilla Shores.
Mr. Greg McMichael was in his front yard working on some cushions for his boat when he sees Mr. Arbery running down the street.
On police body camera, you can hear Greg McMichael kind of excitedly describing how Arbery is running by.
He comes hauling ass down the street. I mean, he ain't jogging. He's hooked up. I run in the house. I said, Travis, the same guy that broke in the house down there. I said, come on, let's go. So Travis runs and gets his shotgun. I grab my 357 Magnum.
At 1:10 p.m., the porch camera picks up Greg and Travis McMichael in their truck, and they're driving, following Ahmaud Arbery, and that's when the chase starts.
Ahmaud then crosses over to Burford Road with the McMichaels following him in their truck.
We see him come around the corner. He's going down here. We pull up beside him and say, hey, stop, we want to talk to you. And he just keeps on running.
William Roddy Bryan has this night owl camera, and on that camera, we see Ahmaud Arbery running by with the McMichaels following in their truck.
Roddy Bryan tells investigators that he's working on his porch when he sees what's happening, so he grabs the keys to his pickup truck and joins the chase.
And I pulled out of my driveway, was going to try to block him.
For 5 minutes, Ahmad is trapped in Satilla Shores, and no matter which way he runs, down Burford or up Holmes, there's a truck blocking him. Roddy Bryan picks up his cell phone and begins recording what you see right here.
I tried to block him again. That didn't happen. They went around me, so I turned around, come back. He started coming back towards me.
Roddy drops his phone. You can hear his truck maneuvering around.
One time when I cornered him up over here, he was trying to get my truck.
You can see some palm prints, appeared to be swipes on the rear driver's side door.
When Travis looks back, he sees Mr. Arbery trying to get into the truck.
He tried to get in my door.
So Travis is very much on guard.
Roddy's video shows Ahmad Arbery running along Holmes Road. And as he meets up with the McMichaels, he's boxed in. At 1:14 p.m., Greg McMichael talks to a 911 operator.
I'm out here at Satilla Shores. There's a black male running down the street.
And so you saw the son, Travis, get out of the truck with a Remington shotgun.
Travis gets out with the damn shotgun.
Ahmad, you can tell, doesn't know what to do. He wants to run around. He goes to the left. He sees Travis. So he goes to the right and then does go around the passenger side of the truck.
We don't know why Ahmad Arbery went to the right and then crossed and turned in front of Travis McMichael's truck.
The guy turns and comes at him.
In the seconds that that confrontation happens, is obscured by the pickup truck. We don't know exactly what went down.
Travis McMichael and Ahmad Arbery were struggling over that shotgun, and then the shots go off. He shoots him 3 times. You see him immediately collapse, and it's over.
A very short time after the shooting occurs, law enforcement is on the scene. And they get out of their vehicle, body cameras are on.
He had no choice there.
You know, you've got the McMichaels walking around, and you've got Ahmad on the ground. Nobody initially focuses on Ahmad. He's the kid that's dying and probably may well not be dead yet.
All right, guys, everybody's got their weapons up, correct?
Everybody's got their weapons up.
Okay.
Once you feel like a scene is safe, then you immediately start rendering care to the person that shot. There is eventually that by another officer that arrives on the scene.
He's still breathing.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to try and do something for him.
I think at that point it's way too late.
Just stay over there for me, sir. Just stay over there. Yeah, there's nothing I can do for this gentleman. He stopped breathing a couple minutes ago. I had pressure on it, but there was nothing I can do.
You can tell Travis is in total distress. He's walking around. He's sort of verbally agonizing.
I told him stop till he hit me. I had nothing to do. There's nothing else I can do. It just doesn't look good. I mean, it just shot me.
Roddy Bryan tries to help police. He admits he has the recording of the shooting.
Nobody got us on video. You just witnessed it, correct?
I got it.
You got it on video?
I ain't looked at it.
I thought he was going to get away.
William Roddy Bryan tells officers that ultimately he was taking that video to identify Ahmad Arbery to police.
Because at this point, I could see his face on my camera. I mean, if the guy would have stopped, you know what I mean, it would have never happened, you know. Should we have been chasing him? I don't know.
Within an hour of the shooting, Roddy is back working on his porch.
February 23rd, everybody went home except Ahmad Arbery.
Travis and Greg McMichael have been stereotyped as Southern rednecks out to kill black people because it's a sport.
Greg sees it as a tragedy.
A tragedy that he and his son set in motion.
Well, one might say a tragedy that Ahmad Arbery set in motion.
If you want to understand how the events of February 23rd unfolded, you have to look at the background of the defendants, as well as their lives in the Satilla Shores neighborhood.
The neighborhood that Ahmaud Arbery was killed in is a middle-class neighborhood. It's predominantly white.
Like a lot of the neighborhoods, it's an interesting combination. You've got some marshfront property where you have some very nice homes, and then you have the interior homes on interior lots, which tend to be smaller and less special.
Graham and Michael had a home there. Graham and Michael was in law enforcement for many years. He was a cop first, and then went to work for the Glenn County District Attorney's Office. He was an investigator with them, had just retired a year previously.
Tell me about his relationship with his son, Travis.
They're close. They both like the water. Of course, Travis was in the Coast Guard, having grown up on the water like Greg did.
Travis grew up in Brunswick. He went to Brunswick High School, graduated in 2004.
I live right there.
Travis McMichael was 34 years old. He moved back in with his parents, and that's where he was, in Satilla Shores.
How you doing, sir?
William Roddy Bryan lived in Satilla Shores, nearby the McMichaels. He worked in a hardware store.
Roddy Bryan is a salt-to-the-earth kind of guy. He's the kind of person that everybody who meets likes.
Nobody got us on video. You just witnessed it.
Yeah, I got it.
Roddy Bryan, I mean, he supplied the next best thing for the prosecution than a confession.
At what point did you start videoing?
Well, I thought he was going to get away.
Okay.
So that was the reason. I don't know what I got, because half the time I was trying to drive.
How well did he know the McMichaels? Did he have a relationship with that family?
He didn't have a relationship with that family.
There was a perspective in that neighborhood that they were being menaced by somebody.
And it really was a neighborhood on edge on February 23rd of 2020.
Why on edge?
Because the volume of theft had become a real issue.
In the months from about October 2019 up to February of 2020, there had been a real uptick in property crimes in the neighborhood.
Did Travis ever report a crime?
Yes. On January 1st, 2020, when his gun was stolen out of his car, he filed a report with the police. Police responded, and they made a report.
Despite the defense claims that there was a spike in crime in the Satilla Shores neighborhood, the prosecution argues that, in reality, there was only one other burglary call between January 2019 and February 23rd, 2020.
Larry English was a homeowner. He had a home under construction in Satilla Shores.
Larry English had reported to a neighbor that about $2,500 worth of electronics equipment had been taken from a boat that was parked at the house. And that's when he decided to get more cameras there.
Later, he'd come to realize that he didn't know for sure where that stuff had gone missing. But to the residents there in Satilla Shores, and specifically the McMichaels, they thought that stuff had disappeared from that construction site.
Larry English had video footage showing people going in and out. Like any construction site in the neighborhood, people will just sort of wander and look and see what the house is.
There were no signs up that says no trespassing. There were no doors on the house at the moment. We saw white couples sort of go on a date there and hang out on the property. We saw children coming to play in this area of interest.
We also saw from Larry English's video a black man on his property on three different occasions. Now, at the time, nobody knew who this man was. It was later confirmed that that man was Ahmaud Arbery.
Ahmaud had been in that house a couple of times, not really picking up anything, not really looking like he intended to do anything, almost in a sense of being curious.
Over the months leading up to the shooting, Larry English had called police several times when his security cameras would alert that somebody was on his property.
There's somebody back over there on the property again tonight. It's a black male, not wearing a shirt, got tattoos on his arms, and a pair of light-colored shorts. Looks like he's up to no good.
There's somebody on the property at 220 Satilla Drive in Brunswick, white male.
By the time the police get there, those people would be gone.
The county police, anybody in here?
So one officer tells English that if this happens again, he should contact his neighbor, Greg McMichael.
Did the families know each other?
No.
They did not?
No. Greg McMichael had not talked directly with Larry English, but he talked to other neighbors about Larry English and the problems he was having with intruders in his home.
No,
What's the address of your emergency?
Satilla Drive, 230 Satilla Drive.
What's going on?
I just caught a guy running into a house being built two houses down from me.
February 11th, just 12 days prior, Travis had left the house to go put gas in his car. And as he drove past the English house, he saw a figure in the yard. And he recognized the guy. He thought, that's the guy we've seen before on the video.
What did he look like?
It's a black male, red shirt, white shorts. When I turned around and saw him and backed up, he reached into his pocket. So I don't know if he's armed or not, but he looked like he was acting like he was.
Do you think he was there to burglarize that home?
Of course not. No.
A lot of people cannot understand, how did a man lose his life when there was no evidence of a serious crime being committed?
That's the wrong question. It's inaccurate. It's not.
What's the right question?
Why did Ahmaud Arbery decide to attack Travis holding a shotgun? Because that's what led to the loss of Ahmaud Arbery's life.
So a guy just on a truck jumps out and points a shotgun at you, and Ahmaud Arbery is supposed to just stop?
The Ahmaud Arbery case is not about black, white. It's about, does a citizen have a right to protect their neighborhood and then ultimately himself?
When you hear that they say that race has no bearing on this case, what is your reaction?
There's three men chasing a black young man. He's unarmed, they have weapons, they have a truck. What else could it be?
My boy been shot three times. Two times in the chest and one time in the arm. And you mean to tell me that ain't hate? This is a racial hate crime. It's hate.
I am a light!
Let's take our light and let's light up the streets out here.
One of the things that this case brings to light is the extent to which race and racism manifests itself on people's bodies. The Ahmaud Arbery case is really a horrible demonstration of that, the extent to which this black man was running through a neighborhood, people saw him, and they responded to him as if he was a threat.
If you see a white man running, you think, well, there's a jogger. You have the ultimate freedom of movement. If you see a black man running, I think you call into question why he's running.
You can't ignore race. I mean, if Ahmaud Arbery was white, I think it's fair to say he'd be alive.
What do we want? What do we want?
This whole community in Glenn County was already aflame with anger, with concern that this was a hate crime that had happened in their own backyard. People saw the vanity plate on Travis McMichael's truck that also has a Confederate emblem on it. So everybody started having a story about the alleged racism of the McMichaels.
Is Greg McMichael a racist?
Well, what's your definition of racist?
Is he somebody who is racially intolerant?
No.
No. If it means I have a belief as a white person, Greg McMichael, that black people are inferior to white people, no. He doesn't believe that.
Travis and Greg McMichael have been stereotyped as Southern rednecks out to kill black people because it's a sport, and there's nothing in their background to suggest that.
There's a clear understanding of the power structure in the South. Whiteness is on top, blackness is subservient. And Ahmaud Arbery became an unfortunate chapter in that long history of Southern culture.
What we have is a string connecting the past and present, and that string is citizen's arrest.
The citizen's arrest law in Georgia allows a private citizen to, if they observe a crime being committed, allows them to detain that person until the police arrive. The history of the citizen's arrest statute in Georgia dates back to the Civil War era.
They passed this law to control enslaved Africans who are trying to flee. It empowers any white person to basically stop any black person and arrest them.
In the aftermath of slavery, 1865, black people were in this sort of strange position, newly freed in the South. And then by the 1880s, that hope turned into terror. Segregation, lynching, the Klan, all of those things were rooted in a set of racist practices that were about organizing where black people could and could not go.
The citizens' arrest laws essentially become cover for the lynching of thousands of African Americans in Georgia and in the American South.
In May of 2021, the state of Georgia amended its citizens' arrest law, dramatically limiting its use.
I think the state of Georgia is moving in the right direction. Unfortunately, I had to lose my son to get significant change, but again, I'm still thankful.
And Wanda, you know, she doesn't want just justice, but she wants change.
The demand for a hate crimes law grew louder after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in South Georgia.
It was sufficient to move the Georgia legislature, one of the most conservative legislatures in the country, to enact a hate crime law.
Ahmaud Arbery's life mattered. Not only did it matter to those who knew him and loved him, it also mattered to state law in Georgia. And nothing can change that. Greg and Travis McMichael did not set out to kill anybody. They set out to detain Ahmaud Arbery until police could arrive.
We see him come around the corner. He's going down here. We pull up beside him. Hey, stop, stop. We want to talk to you. And he just keeps on running.
And Arbery is supposed to know that. These are citizens who are making a citizen's arrest. He's supposed to know that?
What Ahmaud Arbery knows is I've now been caught after having been in that home.
Did police find anything on his body that had been stolen?
No.
Was there anything from the home that he seemed to be carrying at some point?
I told him stop, stop, stop till he hit me. I had nothing to do. There's nothing else I can do.
Greg certainly didn't want Ahmaud Arbery to get hurt or killed. That was not his hope or intention. And so, yeah, that's a tragedy. He sees it as a tragedy.
A tragedy that he and his son set in motion.
Well, one might say a tragedy that Ahmaud Arbery set in motion.
Ahmaud Arbery set in motion by being in a home that wasn't his. On the fifth day of the trial, Kevin Goff drops a bombshell of a comment.
If their pastor's Al Sharpton right now, that's fine, but then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here. If a bunch of folks came in here dressed like Colonel Sanders with white masks sitting in the back, I mean, that would be good.
Tonight, jury selection is about to get underway in the murder trial of three white Georgia men for the fatal shooting of Ahmaud Arbery.
This jury selection was unlike anything that Southeast Georgia had seen. 1,000 people were summoned in order to pick a pool to whittle it down to a jury panel of 12.
We come here today focused on getting justice because you cannot lynch a black man in America in 2021 and think that it would be handled the same way that we handled matters back in the 1950s.
No one knew what the final makeup of that jury plus the alternates were until the special prosecutor, Linda Dunikowski, stood up, and it was a bombshell.
African-American jurors made up one quarter of the jury panel. But the actual jury that was selected has only one African-American male on it.
Of the 12 African-Americans in that pool, the defense had struck 11 of the 12.
To a lot of people, this looked like the epitome of discrimination, especially when you consider that nearly 27% of Glenn County is black.
This court has found that there appears to be intentional discrimination in the panel. Quite a few African-American jurors were excused through peremptory strikes exercised by the defense. But that doesn't mean the court has the authority to reseat.
In the court of public opinion, it just didn't sit well with many of the leaders in the community that this jury would not accurately reflect the community where Ahmaud Arbery was killed.
We're going to turn now to the very difficult start to the trial in the Ahmaud Arbery case today, the emotional scene inside that courtroom in Georgia.
Why are we here? We are here because of assumptions and driveway decisions.
Special Prosecutor Linda Donikowski got up and talked for nearly an hour and a half, laying out slowly and piece by piece what she thought this jury should know.
Greg McMichael is in front of 230 Stilla Drive. He's all alone, and he sees Mr. Arbery running really, really fast down the street. He actually uses the words, hauling ass. Ladies and gentlemen, this is driveway decision number one. And what does he decide to do? He runs inside to get his gun. He's assumed the worst and has absolutely no immediate knowledge of any crime whatsoever.
That really set the tone for this entire case, that this jury needed to focus on the fact that the defendants didn't have any concrete evidence when they decided to go chase and ultimately kill Ahmaud Arbery.
Travis McMichael made a decision, a knowing, intelligent decision, to pick up a Remington 12-gauge shotgun and go with his father and get in his pickup truck to go after Mr. Arbery. Driveway decision number two. And then Mr. Bryan makes his driveway decision. And he joins the McMichaels in chasing down Mr. Arbery. Greg McMichael said it perfectly. Mr. Arbery was trapped like a rat. That's what he told the police. Trapped like a rat.
The defense, through their opening statements, made it very clear that they believe the McMichaels were defending their neighborhood.
This case is about duty and responsibility. It's about Travis McMichael's duty and responsibility to himself, to his family, and to his neighborhood.
They continuously use the arguments of self-defense and citizen's arrest, highlighting that the video doesn't tell the whole story.
Travis has no choice but to fire his weapon in self-defense. He's on Travis, and Travis has to fire. Because at that point, it's his life or Ahmaud Arbery's life.
As the state went on presenting its case, they played for the jury that video recorded by Roddy Bryan.
Mr. Arbery ran away from these three defendants in their pickup trucks for 5 minutes.
Marcus Arbery, Ahmaud's father, walked out of court. He didn't want to see it. Wanda Cooper Jones sat in the back corner of that courtroom and for the first time saw the complete video of her son being shot.
I avoided the video for the last 18 months and I thought it was time to get familiar with what happened to Ahmaud. I'm glad I was able to stay strong and stay in there.
At this time, the state will call Officer Jeffrey Brandenberry.
The prosecution calls to the witness stand the Glenn County police officers who arrived on the scene after Ahmaud had been shot.
Did Greg McMichael ever indicate to you at that time that he thought Ahmaud Arbery, the guy, had committed a crime that day?
No, ma'am.
While speaking with you, did Greg McMichael ever use the word burglary?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever use the word trespass?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever tell you while you're talking to him that he was attempting to make a citizen's arrest?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever even use the word arrest?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever even use the word detain?
No, ma'am.
The defense is going to have to prove that they suspected Ahmaud was committing a felony in order for the McMichaels to claim they were trying to make a citizen's arrest.
Your Honor, I was reminded of one matter that I wanted to address.
On the fifth day of the trial, without the jury present, Kevin Goff makes a bombshell of a comment.
The Right Reverend Al Sharpton managed to find his way into the back of the courtroom. If we're going to bring high-profile members of the African-American community into the courtroom to sit with the family during the trial in the presence of the jury, I believe that's intimidating and it's an attempt to pressure. And if their pastor's Al Sharpton right now, that's fine, but then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here. If a bunch of folks came in here dressed like Colonel Sanders with white masks sitting in the back, I mean, that would be terrible.
That statement was totally asinine, ridiculous. This case is not about racism or racist motives. This is just a neighborhood and some people trying to do the best they could to stop the crime in the neighborhood.
The defense insists it's not about race, but everywhere you look, every time you try to get away from race, race comes back in.
I will follow up with a more specific motion on Monday, and my apologies to anyone who might have inadvertently been offended.
Kevin Goff gave what he called an apology, but it wasn't taken that way by a lot of people.
He spoke his mind. Actually, I mean, he spoke his heart.
All right, for the jury.
After the state rested, the defense really hadn't signaled who their witnesses were going to be and whether any of the defendants were going to take the stand.
We're asking the court not to ask him if he's going to testify or not, but the court can inform him of his rights.
Then, to everybody's surprise, Travis McMichael, the man who actually shot and killed Ahmaud Arbery, takes the witness stand.
Swear to tell the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Kevin Goff's statement about black pastors being in the gallery created a windstorm of a reaction.
He said, no more black pastors. Look at what you brought now.
Outside the Glynn County Courthouse in Georgia today, hundreds of black pastors came to pray.
God, we're looking for a miracle.
Black pastors in Georgia, black pastors in America, are synonymous with the civil rights movement.
It speaks to the two different Americas that still exist. That for this white man, this lawyer, he saw the presence of black ministers as a menace, as a threat. In black America, these are revered figures who provide comfort and context in difficult moments.
Amen.
Inside the Glynn County courtroom, the defense is now presenting its case.
Defense calls Travis McMichael.
When Travis McMichael was called as the first defense witness, it shocked everyone. Jaws were dropping. Travis McMichael looked a lot different on the stand than he did in the body camera footage.
Putting Travis on the stand does make him more humane and likable than what the video presents him as.
I want to give my side of the story. I want to explain what happened.
Travis's lawyers have tried to put together a picture of him as someone who cared about safety, someone who cared about the well-being of his parents.
Did they share things with you about what they were hearing happening in the neighborhood about crime?
They did.
Travis McMichael was able to give this jury his Coast Guard history, his training as a law enforcement officer.
Do you have any training on hand-to-hand combat?
Yes.
Did you have any training on how to retain your weapon?
Yes.
The defense wants to suggest that he was essentially the pseudo cop in his neighborhood.
Did you want to stop him and hold him so the police could come and arrest him?
That was my plan, yes, sir.
The courtroom is silent as Travis McMichael talks about those final moments with Ahmaud Arbery.
What did you do?
I shot.
Why?
He had my gun. He struck me. It was obvious that he was, it was obvious that he was attacking me, that if he would have got the shotgun from me, then it was, this is a life or death situation. And I'm gonna have to stop him from doing this, so I shot.
This was a major risk to take the stand as a defendant in this case because they are faced with a video that shows them chasing Ahmaud Arbery. They'd have to explain why they did that. And the danger is that they don't have a concrete reason to be chasing him.
Thank you, Judge. The prosecutor, Linda Denikowski, came out of the gate really hot. She went straight to the cornerstone of the defense's case, which is all wrapped up in citizen's arrest.
Not once during your direct examination did you state that your intention was to effectuate an arrest of Mr. Arbery until your attorney asked you that leading question. Isn't that right?
Yes.
The prosecutor is clearly trying to get Travis McMichael to acknowledge that he never saw Ahmaud Arbery doing anything wrong.
And you had no idea what he'd actually been doing that day?
Not at that time, no.
One of the most effective parts of the prosecutor's cross-examination is when she asks Travis McMichael what Ahmaud Arbery wasn't doing, and she gives a list.
And he never yelled at you guys?
No, ma'am.
Never threatened you at all?
Yeah, he did not threaten me verbally, no, ma'am.
It essentially was poking a hole over and over in the defense's claim of self-defense.
Didn't brandish any weapons?
No, ma'am.
Didn't pull out any guns?
No, ma'am.
Didn't pull out any knife?
No, ma'am.
Never reached for anything, did he?
No.
He just rang?
Yes, he was just rang.
The prosecutor really challenged Travis McMichael's contention that Arbery was a threat to him.
Your father is in the pickup truck, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And he has his .357 Magnum, correct?
He has it, yes.
Finally, she built this picture of the power imbalance of an exhausted young man coming up to this huge pickup truck with two armed white men.
So you're telling this jury that a man who has spent 5 minutes running away from you, you're now thinking is somehow going to want to continue to engage with you, someone with a shotgun, and your father, a man who's just said, stop or I'll blow your head off, by trying to get in their truck?
That's what it shows, yes, ma'am.
Over the course of 2 days, Travis McMichael testifies for 6 hours. He would be the only defendant to take the stand. The only other witnesses called by the defense?
Swear to tell the truth, tell the truth, and nothing but the truth.
Happy.
A handful of neighbors in Sotilla Shores.
The defense was trying to create this continuous narrative of a neighborhood under threat. They wanted neighbors to corroborate what Travis McMichael had said was true, which was the neighborhood was on edge.
Other than the homicide of Mr. Arbery, violent crimes were few and far between or non-existent in the neighborhood. Is that correct?
That is correct.
This is ironic. The most violent crime that these neighbors in Sotilla Shores would have witness is the death of Ahmaud Arbery, which was carried out by one of their own.
We turn next to closing arguments in the Ahmaud Arbery case.
It was clear that in the prosecution's closing in this case, they wanted to drive home this idea of just how imbalanced the situation was on February 23rd.
3-on-1, 2 pickup trucks, 2 guns. They want you to believe that he is a danger to them, and he was scary.
After the closing arguments, it's now up to the jury to decide the fate of the 3 men. The jury deliberated for 11 hours. Outside the courthouse, a crowd has been gathering, waiting for the verdict.
Madam Foreperson, I understand you have reached a verdict as to each defendant.
Yeah.
It's the day before Thanksgiving, and a crowd has now gathered outside the courthouse. After 11 hours of deliberation, the jury has reached a verdict.
Madam Foreperson, please hand your verdict forms to the sheriff. Mr. McMichael, please stand. Verdict is as follows. In the Superior Court of Glynn County, State of Georgia, the State of Georgia versus Travis McMichael. Count 1, malice murder. We, the jury, find the defendant, Travis McMichael, guilty.
She vowed to find justice for her son, and Wanda Cooper Jones kept her promise.
As to Gregory McMichael, count 2, felony murder. Guilty. As to William R. Bryan, count 3, felony murder. Guilty.
All 3 men guilty of murder. Ahmaud Arbery's family has been waiting more than 1 year and 8 months for this moment.
And let the word go forth all over the world that a jury of 11 whites and 1 black,
come on,
in the deep south,
good God,
stood up in the courtroom and said that black lives do matter.
Come on.
Let's keep fighting. Let's keep doing it and making this place a better place for all human beings.
Amen.
I never thought this day would come. Thank you for those who marched,
those who prayed, most of all the ones who prayed.
Yes, Lord.
The verdict shows in this case of the death of Ahmaud Arbery that citizen's arrest and self-defense was not something that the jury bought.
I was deeply disappointed. I mean, I really felt that this jury was going to acquit Mr. Bryan.
There's enough tragedy in this case to go around. Lee McMichael has lost her husband and her son through this verdict, and she's devastated.
I hope history looks back on this case as a case where we sought justice for Ahmaud, we sought justice for the family, and that justice was done.
What would you say to the McMichaels and Mr. Bryan, if you could?
Ahmaud's not coming home. I've lost my son. They go to jail. They still have life. I've lost my son.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt
the cartridge.
What were you thinking in that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.